Good evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. And really be aware of this opportunity to practice. That when we die, we go on completely alone. This whole ego identity dissolves, and everything we're familiar with here we leave behind. Only our karma comes with us, and the habits we've created. And so, since death is definite, and as long as we have self-grasping ignorance, rebirth is definite, then it's important to use this present life to practice the Dharma, to try and realize reality, so that at the time of death we don't grasp or hold on to anything, but are actually able to transform the death experience into the path to awakening. And so to do this, we need to learn the teachings. And we also need to cultivate a compassionate heart for all beings, really extending ourselves and wanting to attain full awakening for the benefit of all the living beings who have been kind to us and upon whom we depend. So with that kind of thought, let's share in the Dharma this evening. Questions that came in, and I thought I would start with the questions and then go on from there. Okay, so one question is regarding the, when I talked about polluted karma and unpolluted karma, and so this person is saying when, you know, as far as cyclic existence continues, the grasping at true existence makes our actions polluted. But they can still be, we can still create virtuous actions. Remember, I made that differentiation. Okay, so the question is regarding dedication. If we dedicate the merit to awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings, with just an intellectual understanding of emptiness, is the karma still polluted? Okay, so, yeah. Okay, unpolluted karma is when we have direct insight into emptiness. Okay, so even if we have a conceptual understanding of emptiness, it's not direct. Okay, so it's certainly something that is going to be very conducive, and you know, we want to cultivate that, and that will take us towards enlightenment, but it's not unpolluted karma yet. So even though it could be bodhicitta, even though we could have the, you know, an intellectual understanding of emptiness, it's still not yet unpolluted karma. Okay? Yeah? So, yes?
So, once you have the direct perception, if you made that dedication then, because once you have the direct perception, it doesn't, like, instantly, you don't have a whole mind that realizes emptiness all the time.
Right.
So, is there some, like, some moments when you're aware of it, you have polluted karma, yeah. And some moments not.
Okay, so after you've attained the path of seeing, and you have direct awareness, direct perception of emptiness, do you only create unpolluted karma? That I'm not sure of. I know you would definitely create it in meditative equipoise, but in subsequent attainment, when you still have the the appearance of true existence, I'm not sure if you create polluted karma at that time or not. I don't know. Okay, then there's another question. When you develop bare awareness, do thoughts eventually stop coming, or do you recognize them as thoughts without reacting to them? Okay, so this meditation on bare awareness, I'm not sure what exact tradition the person who asked it is practicing, because it can be taught in a Dzogchen sort of way. It can be taught in a like Burmese Vipassana sort of way. So there's different meanings to that. But just to speak in general, okay, the purpose of meditation isn't simply to get rid of thoughts. Okay? This is kind of a common misperception or misconception that, you know, we're just trying to get rid of all thought. Okay? Now, true, a Buddha doesn't have any thought. And true, a direct perception of emptiness isn't with conceptual mind or thought. But at the beginning of the practice, thought is very useful for learning the teachings. For example, right now, we're dealing with thought and conceptual consciousness, aren't we? In teaching and hearing the teachings and trying to understand them. So, just clearing away thought, all thought whatsoever from our mind, is not the purpose of meditation, because you can clear away thought and still have self-grasping ignorance. Okay? So, yeah, because the self-grasping ignorance is very subtle, it, of course, is a thought, but, you know, you can be in a state of samadhi, like in some of the form and formless realm absorptions. You don't have any gross kind of thought, but you haven't realized the nature of reality. And so, you know, when the karma runs out for those kind of rebirths, then you just get born again in samsara. So I always joke that cows don't think a lot, but they aren't enlightened. Unless we say, holy cow, thinking, you know, that somehow they have realizations. Okay. Now, definitely, we do want to eliminate all the discursive thought of useless conceptions, you know, ridiculous memories, disturbing emotions, all that kind of thought, yes, we want to get rid of, okay? But, you know, learning how to think clearly is actually one step on the practice. And I think it's an important step. Because you can get kind of very concentrated and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of thought. And you think you have realizations, but then when you come out of meditation, you know, all sorts of negative thoughts can be there. Yeah? There was a book, I never read it, and I forget its title, but the idea about it was, that you had all these roshis in Japan during World War II who were supposedly enlightened, and yet they were supporting the Japanese government and the way they were invading different countries and the kind of cruelty that was going on. And so people were saying, wait a minute, how can you be an awakened being and still, you know, support these kinds of things? So while I cannot make a definitive statement on these particular Roshis, because I don't know their level of attainment at all, you know, sometimes high bodhisattvas can act in ways that we don't understand at all. But what I can say is that somebody can have samadhi and yet still have, you know, manifest disturbing, you know, emotions when they come out of their meditation. And so that's why, you know, just clearing away all the chatter from our mind doesn't necessarily mean that we're cleared away from afflictions. Okay? So that's why it's quite important to develop renunciation and bodhicitta, but especially the correct view of emptiness. Okay? But when you are settling the mind down, and if you are doing the meditation of watching thoughts arise and watching them cease, you know, you do get to a point where they arise and cease and you don't buy into them, you don't react to them so much. And then after a while they say that those thoughts just stop arising and altogether. Okay. But again, unless you have the realization of emptiness, that's not going to be, you know, something that's going to take you directly to enlightenment. Okay? So, you know, we do have to be aware of all of our chattering thoughts and try and let go of them and not buy into them. But I also think it's important that we don't just observe the thoughts, but we also understand why certain thoughts are afflictive and other ones aren't. Okay? Because remember the fourth establishment of mindfulness about phenomena? The purpose of that was to be able to discern afflictive thoughts and emotions from unafflictive thoughts and emotions, so we know what to practice and what to abandon. So if we just do meditation, watching the thoughts arise and cease, we may not necessarily develop the discriminating wisdom that can tell the difference between virtuous and non-virtuous thoughts. Because our afflictions are so sneaky, and our self-grasping is so strong, and our self-centeredness is so pervasive, that we can fool ourselves into anything. Yeah? So I think it's really important to be able to see, for example, how the way anger thinks is incorrect, how it's false. You know, and to be able to really see how the way attachment thinks is also erroneous. And then to be able to identify ignorance when it's manifest in our mind, which is really hard. Okay? So I think all of this is very important. Otherwise, we might just see thoughts arise and cease, and release one thought and another thought and another thought, and we might have a very calm mind. But then, when we're out of our meditation and things arise, you know, do we have the wisdom that can see, oh, this is attachment and I shouldn't follow it? Because attachment feels good. Yeah. So when it arises, we want to follow. We don't necessarily see attachment as a disturbing emotion, because very often when we have it, it feels good. Okay? So, you know, it's really deceptive, very deceptive. And that's why we have to be able to see. Even if it feels good, it doesn't necessarily mean it's virtuous. Yeah? And you know how we can all talk ourselves into our anger being justified. I mean, we're very good at that. Other people's anger, definitely unjustified. But my anger is different. My anger is virtuous anger. It's righteous anger. It's the anger that's going to stop all these horrible people. And of course, the definition of horrible people are people who don't agree with my ideas. Yeah? So my self-centeredness is the arbiter of what is virtue and non-virtue. Now, that's not a very good arbiter. You know, my self-centeredness evaluates what is beneficial and not beneficial. That's not good to trust. Okay? So it's hard for us to tell even when the self-centered mind arises, isn't it? You know? It can be very hard because it's so sneaky. It always pretends to be our friend. And we follow it. You know? We salute our self-centered mind. We curtsy to our self-centered mind. We let it run the show. And we can't tell the difference. I've been... I can talk a little bit about the current events. What's happening in Libya, and Gaddafi is making these speeches, and it's unbelievable that he has been the leader of a country for 42 years, because what he is saying and what he is thinking is very, very afflicted, you know, and he can't tell the difference between an afflicted thought and a virtuous thought. Yeah? So you can have a lot of power and a lot of people respecting you and a lot of ignorance and a lot of self-centeredness, you know, and not be able to tell the difference. And so in giving these speeches, and we saw it with Mubarak also, you know, people who really think that what they're saying is benevolent and for the benefit of other people, but you know, they're out to lunch. Yeah? And it's quite scary, the influence that they can have on other people. And it's quite scary when I think of being born with that kind of mind and that kind of position and the karma that somebody creates by having that kind of power and doing those actions with so much ignorance and confusion. Yeah? Thinking that what they're doing is good and helpful. Okay? So this is, you know, why this fourth establishment of mindfulness and phenomena is so important. Yeah? So we can really tell the difference in our own experience and, you know, not get fooled ourselves. Okay. So let's go back to our text where... nearing completion of this text, and then we will go on to, because what we've been doing here is, I mean, even though these meditations are so juicy and we can see how they're leading us to understand aspects of our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena that we've never even considered before, still, these are considered coarse mindfulnesses compared to the subtle establishments of mindfulness according to the Majjhimaka view, which we'll get into afterwards. And there we'll take it from Shanti Devas, chapter 9. Okay, but we'll get to that. Let's finish this first. I'm just dangling the carrot. Okay, so we completed point 6, the boundary, when you have the actual establishment of mindfulness, and it was from the path of accumulation, the first path, up through the Buddha ground, the last path, the path of no more learning. Okay, then the seventh point in the text is the etymology. And here the root text says, by being mindful of an object observed by wisdom, it is said to be establishment. And since we do not forget it, it is said to be establishment of mindfulness. Okay? So, because we are mindful of an object that is being observed with wisdom, because remember we were talking that mindfulness and wisdom go together here. Therefore, it's called establishment. We're establishing our mind on an object that we know with mindful wisdom. Okay? And since we don't forget it, it's said to be the establishment of mindfulness. Because remember, mindfulness is also the word for memory or remembering an object. Okay? So we don't forget the object that we're observing with wisdom. Establishment of mindfulness. Yeah?
Does it mean, though, observed by wisdom, in the sense of, is that like we're seeing things correctly?
Yeah. When we're talking about observed by wisdom, we're talking about, you know, a wisdom. It could be, you know, at the beginning levels, a conventional wisdom that knows the foulness of the body, or the suffering nature of the feelings, or the impermanence of the mind, or it could be an ultimate wisdom, or a wisdom of the ultimate, that knows the emptiness of true existence of all these things.
So it kind of starts with actually seeing the four distortions.
Yeah, wisdom is very much the opposite of the four distortions. It's the counteractive thing of the four distortions. Okay, so just to some new people, the four distortions, when we see things that are impermanent as permanent, when we see things that are foul by nature as being pure, when we see things that are unsatisfactory or dukkha by nature as happiness or bliss, when we see things that lack a self, particularly a substantial self, as having some substantial self or substantial existence. Okay? And so those are four distortions that we pretty much function on all day long. And so this is what I was meaning. It's like, you know, these are gross distortions, but we don't even realize them. You know, I was thinking about it today when we, talking about seeing impermanent things as permanent. Because I was thinking, you know, if somebody asked you, is this paper clip permanent or impermanent? You know, does it change moment by moment or does it stay the same? You'd probably say it was impermanent. You know, if you've studied science and you know that, you know, all the different subatomic particles are changing and rotating and moving and everything, you'd look at this and say, yeah, it's impermanent. All the subatomic things are moving. It's not the same moment to moment. But even though we have that awareness that, you know, on a subatomic level, there's subtle impermanence, when we look at this paper clip, we think it's the exact same paperclip from one moment to the next. It's as if all the atoms that make it up are changing, but the paperclip remains the same. Isn't it? Isn't it? You know, all the atoms are impermanent, but the paperclip is static. It doesn't change. This shows you how ignorant we are. Yeah? Because when we get up, you know, each morning, we think we're the same person as yesterday. And the people we see, we think they're all the same people that we saw yesterday. And yet, if somebody asked us, are you permanent or impermanent, we would say, well, I'm impermanent. You know, my body's changing moment by moment. My mind's changing moment by moment. These things are impermanent. I'm still the same. Now, how could that be? You know, that doesn't make any logical sense at all. Because the self is labeled in dependence upon the body and mind. So if the body and mind are impermanent, the self has to be impermanent. It can't be permanent. Yeah? So you can see, yeah, get an idea of what ignorance means. Sometimes when you have a strong meditation, it's absolutely shocking, totally shocking to understand how our minds are completely out of touch with reality. Totally out of touch with reality. And yet, day by day, we think that what we're perceiving is real. And we're sure of it. And we're sure it's an objective reality. And we're sure that how we think of things is the correct way. And yet, once in a while, you have a really clear meditation, and you go, this is unbelievable. I'm out to lunch, you know? Maybe not as bad as Gaddafi, but almost. You know? Give me a little bit more, you know, time, and I could very, very well be like him. You know what he's saying is why there's the revolt in Libya? Because Al-Qaeda is giving drugs to the young people. Giving them hallucinogenics. But you know, when somebody accuses us of something, we deny any involvement and tell them it's all their own. And make, you know, tell them they're the ones who are creating the whole thing. And, you know, we always blame other people too, don't we? Yeah, it's never our fault for when we have problems. Always somebody else's. Always, isn't it? Never mine. Or if it is mine, then it's totally my fault and I'm irredeemable. Yeah. Totally hopeless. Yeah. We're just as extreme as Al-Qaeda. Are we? In the way we think. You know? Either all good, all, you know, I'm wonderful, or I'm terrible, or this or that. I mean, you know, our minds are nuts. This is the force of ignorance. Okay. So you see, we shouldn't judge anybody else. Because, you know, not so much difference is there. Okay. Number 8. Demonstrating that the practice of establishment of mindfulness in the Mahayana as superior. So we're going to make a case for Mahayana here. It's the best way. Okay. Better than any other way. And we're Mahayana, so we're the best ones. Aren't we? Everybody else should be like us. Because we're best. Because we cherish all sentient beings more than ourselves. Right? We don't have any self-centeredness, even though we're the best. Okay, so here's another good example why we should not judge other people. Okay, and why we shouldn't believe everything we think. Yeah, because if you're arrogant about being following the Mahayana tradition, then you're not following the Mahayana tradition. Okay. So when we talk of Mahayana here, we're talking of the people who are practicing with the intention to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, We're talking about a practice tradition here when we're talking about Mahayana. We could also be talking about the Mahayana philosophical tenets, because Mahayana can have two meanings. One is a practice tradition according to our motivation, and the other is the philosophical tenets. So, for example, the mind only and the middle way tenets are both considered, Mahayana tenets. So actually here, when we go through this, we will encounter both meanings of Mahayana. Okay? It's interesting, I've been reading, when Mahayana first started to appear in ancient India, it was more a motivation that people had. It wasn't an individual kind of group. It wasn't, people who had some big, strong identity going, rah-rah, Mahayana. It seems like the people who followed the Bodhisattva path were living in the same monasteries as people who followed the Hira and Solitary Realizer path. Okay, they were living in the same monasteries. They respected, their abbots and preceptors, even if their abbots and preceptors were hearers or solitary realizers and they were following the Mahayana. And then later, as time went on, then Mahayana, also became known as a group of sutras, the Mahayana sutras. And then slowly it became, after several hundred years, actually, it became more of a different tradition. Yeah, but at the beginning, it wasn't. Everybody kind of lived together, and people often think, the Theravadas, they aren't Mahayanist. They don't have a bodhisattva path. Well, actually, in Theravada Buddhism, there is a bodhisattva path. And there is a scripture that talks about, how the Buddha generated bodhicitta and how, his name was Sumedha, the time he generated bodhicitta, and then how through many lifetimes he practiced the six paramis, that's the Pali word for paramitas, the far-reaching practices. Yeah, so it's there in the Pali tradition too. So we shouldn't get so categorical in boxing people into categories and so on. Okay, so first, what is it that makes these meditations a Mahayana practice? So the primary thing is the motivation. Okay. A secondary thing is also your view of emptiness, but here primary is the motivation. Okay. And so we were talking before that the hearers and solitary realizers will meditate on their own body as something foul, but the bodhisattvas will meditate on others' bodies also as foul, and so that they can develop strong compassion for those beings who are born in those bodies due to afflictions and karma. Okay? So the way that a bodhisattva approaches these four establishments of mindfulness is always through the viewpoint of compassion and meditating on these four in a way that will increase their compassion and thus increase their bodhicitta. Okay, so if you're just aiming to be free of your own foul body or polluted body, then that's not Mahayana. If you're aiming for all sentient beings to be free of their polluted bodies, then that's Mahayana. Okay? And then in terms of the view, if you're talking about Mahayana in terms of the view, then you're going to be looking at the four, the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, as being empty of inherent existence. Okay? as I was saying earlier in the talk, seeing these four as impure, as in the nature of unsatisfactory in nature, as impermanent, and as lacking a substantial self or not being a substantial self, this is a gross way of regarding these four. And even though we can see it's very profound as we hear these teachings, we're all being very deeply affected by them. Okay? So from our viewpoint, it's profound, but this is also a viewpoint that is shared by all the Buddhist tenet systems. Whereas what's unique to the Mahayana tenet system is seeing the selflessness of phenomena. And in particular, if we're talking about the Prasangika Madhyamaka tenet system, Mahayana tenet system, then seeing the four as empty of true existence. Okay? And so that's much more profound. Okay? So, in other words, to really make it Mahayana, we need, on the method side, the great compassion in bodhicitta, and on the wisdom side, the prasangika view of emptiness. Okay? Probably the Chittamatra view of emptiness could be considered Mahayana too, but here it's like, why monkey around with the Chittamatras? So let's just go for the prasangika. Okay? Okay, because then when we have the method side of compassion and bodhicitta, the wisdom side of the correct view, then those two together, you know, make the practice one that will enable us to attain full awakening. Okay, then another reason that the bodhisattvas meditate on the four establishments of mindfulness is not only for their own practice, you know, to gain insight into emptiness and to develop bodhicitta, but also they learn how to meditate according to how the hearers and solitary realizers meditate on these four, because they will teach people who are following the hearer and solitary realizer vehicle. Okay? So when bodhisattvas become Buddhas, or even when they're bodhisattvas, you know, because the whole thing about bodhisattvas is they really try and understand all the different temperaments and dispositions of different sentient beings, and then they tailor the teachings that they give according to these temperaments and interests and dispositions. So, of course, some people are going to be, you know, have more predisposition towards the hearer or solitary realizer path. So a bodhisattva has to know how to teach these four establishments of mindfulness in a way that's going to correspond to that person's mentality. Okay? So a bodhisattva or a Buddha doesn't just teach it the way they want to because they think, you know, this is the absolute best way to do it. They teach it according to what that person needs to hear, because that's what's best for that particular person at that moment of time. Okay? So you can see, you know, how important it is, if we're going to be bodhisattvas, to develop some kind of ability, you know, and to tell what people's interests and dispositions are, and also to respect what their interests and dispositions are, you know. So somebody may be attracted to a path that's different than ours. They may be attracted to a teacher that's different from ours. They may have all sorts of different interests, different ways of thinking. But, you know, if we're really skillful, then we learn how to take what that person's, the raw material of their interests and dispositions, and then teach them the Buddha Dharma in a way that fits with what they need at that particular time. Okay? So it's, you know, it's really very skillful. Yeah. It's like when you're, you know, when you're dealing with somebody in fifth grade, yeah, you know, college calculus might be the best. But they're in fifth grade, so you teach them fifth grade math. You know, if they can handle that, if they can handle seventh grade math, you teach them that. If they're still at third grade arithmetic, you teach them that. Okay? So you really see where people are at and what's going to be the most beneficial thing for them to hear. Yeah? And so that's, you know, really, I think, a very profound element of the Mahayana practice is that kind of deep respect, you know, of people. I say this because sometimes, once in a while, I meet somebody who is a I call them a born-again Mahayanist, okay? And it's usually somebody who's read the Lotus Sutra and has taken the Lotus Sutra very much to heart and very literally. And, you know, when the Lotus Sutra says, you know, because the Lotus Sutra is very strong on saying that everybody can attain enlightenment. You know, there's one final vehicle. Everybody's going to enlightenment. That the hearer and solitary realizers, they may get to their own, you know, a level of enlightenment, but eventually they have to enter the bodhisattva path and attain full enlightenment. Okay? So you meet somebody who's heard this, and then the Lotus Sutra talks about if you disbelieve this, how it's, you know, it's like criticizing all the Buddhas and all this kind of stuff. So you meet somebody who's read this, who doesn't know the context to put it in, and they really become like a born-again Mahayanist. And it's like, give me a break, okay? You know, I mean, I love bodhicitta too, but, you know. Okay? And so this is, you can really see that what that person's missing is, you know, the skillful means that is so apparent if you really study the Lotus Sutra well. Because the Lotus Sutra gives so many examples about how the Buddha teaches different things for different levels of disciples. Yeah. And I always tell people when I first met my teacher at LA International Airport, he talked to me about dolphins. Because that was the level of my mind. Okay, so yeah, there was somebody staying at my house who, because the teachers were coming in to give a course, and I said, you know, people could stay in my house. So there was somebody who was an old student who was staying at my house, and she wanted to go to the airport to meet Rinpoche when he was flying in. So I had just gotten done with a dance rehearsal. I was in a semi-professional folk dancing group, you know, so with my hair down to here and my long earrings and my cha-cha-cha stuff, you know. I, the great Bodhisattva, decides to drive her to LA International Airport, you know. Okay, let's go, you know, see who this guy is. And, you know, and that's where I met the person who was to become my teacher and talked to me about dolphins. Because he had just been in Hawaii or someplace like that and, you know, had seen some dolphins.
It worked.
It worked! Yeah, it did, didn't it? Yeah, the skill of the Buddha, it worked. It worked. Okay. So now back to our root text. It says the establishment of mindfulness in the Mahayana is superior to that of the fundamental vehicle, in other words, the hearers and solitary realizers, because meditation on it is superior in 14 ways. Okay, so first is its aim is the Mahayana. In other words, the Bodhisattva's practice is aimed towards full enlightenment. Okay, it's aimed, you know, with the great compassion, the Bodhicitta. Two, it relies on the wisdom that understands the lack of a self or phenomena. Okay, So it has, it's also Mahayana in terms of the tenet system. Yeah, understands the lack of a self of phenomena. In other words, that every single thing that exists does not have its own inherent essential nature. Okay, on an ultimate level. Three is it acts as a remedy to the 16 mistaken views. Okay, so the 16 mistaken views. When we talk about the Four Noble Truths, there's 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, four for each of the Four Noble Truths, and there's 16 mistaken views that these 16 aspects are counteracting. So, for example, the Noble Truth of Dukkha, the four aspects, you know, the four mistaken views are that things are pure, permanent, pleasurable, and have a self. And the four counteracting views are that they're impermanent and the nature of dukkha and empty and selfless. Okay? And so like this for the other three truths, there's four wrong views and then four correct views that you're trying to generate. So the Mahayana practice of the four foundations, four establishments of mindfulness is a remedy to these 16 mistaken views. Okay? Then four is it engages us in meditation on the Four Noble Truths. Okay? So remember, we've gone through this many times, that each one of the objects of the four establishments relates to one of the noble truths. Okay, so the body relates to truth of dukkha. Okay, the feelings relate to
the cause.
Okay, the origin or cause, the second noble truth. The mind relates to true cessation, and phenomena, mindfulness on phenomena, relates to
true
paths. Okay? And so we've been through this before, so then you can see how these four establishments get us involved in meditation on the Four Noble Truths. Okay? Then five is it observes the body and so forth of all beings, both ourselves and others. Okay, so we've covered this too, that when, you know, bodhisattva's doing it, they're meditating on the bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena in relationship to all sentient beings, not just in relationship to themselves. Okay, then six, it is attentive to the body and so forth. Okay, so forth means feelings, mind, and phenomena. Being empty of inherent existence. Yeah, so a bodhisattva practice of these four is not only seeing them as dukkha in nature, as impermanent, as foul, but also as empty of inherent existence. Okay? Then seven is it helps us to attain an unpolluted body after having been freed from a polluted body. Okay? So polluted body is one that we take under the influence of ignorance and karma and afflictions. So polluted by ignorance. Okay? So when we attain the path of seeing in the Mahayana, then we attain a mental body, a body that's the nature of mind, and that is an that body is, it's unpolluted in this, well, it's still a polluted body in the sense that there's still the cognitive obscurations, okay? So it's only at enlightenment that you really get a real, genuine, unpolluted body. You know, when you've eliminated all the cognitive obscurations. But still, at the path of seeing, when you have a mental body, It's much better than this thing. Okay? Much better. The cognitive obscurations. Okay, there's two levels of obscurations. One called afflictive obscurations, one called the cognitive obscurations. The afflictive obscurations prevent us from attaining liberation, and their ignorance, afflictions, and all the karma that causes us to take rebirth and cyclic existence. And then the cognitive obscurations prevent us from attaining full omniscience, Buddhahood, okay, full enlightenment, and they are the subtle latencies of all the afflictions and the appearance or the perception of true existence that those subtle latencies produce. Okay? So Comparatively, the afflictive obscurations, the ignorance and anger and attachment and those things, they're comparatively gross compared to the cognitive obscurations. So it's, you know, you don't even start eliminating the cognitive obscurations until you're already a very high-level bodhisattva. Okay? But we aim for it, and we're going there. Okay? Okay, then number 8 is the Mahayana establishments of mindfulness accords with the 6 far-reaching practices. Okay, so, you know, it's in accordance with, you know, the far-reaching generosity, far-reaching ethical conduct, and so forth. And remember, I was saying before that generosity and far-reaching generosity are different. You know, fortitude and far-reaching fortitude are different. What's the difference? Yeah, so the difference is that you have the bodhicitta and you have an understanding of the realization of the circle of three, the agent, object, and action. Okay? Because generosity is something that, you know, everybody, whether you have a religion or not, thinks is good, and most people engage in it. And it's a virtuous practice. But to make it far-reaching generosity, then we need the bodhicitta and an understanding of emptiness. Okay? Then number 9 is, it accords with caring for the hearers, solitary realizers, and so forth. So forth means the bodhisattvas. So when you learn, you know, these 4 establishments, from a Mahayana viewpoint, then you can teach the hearers and solitary realizers as well as the bodhisattvas. Okay? Then 10 is, through it, we know the body to be like an illusion, the feelings to be like a dream, the mind to be like space, and phenomena to be like clouds. Okay? Very nice analogies. Yeah, they're telling us to chill out, you know, and don't grasp things. This is so real. So the body is like an illusion. It appears to be truly existent, but it's not. Okay? The feelings are like a dream. They seem so real. But when you wake up, it's gone. Okay? The mind is like space. You try and locate the mind and pinpoint the mind and put the mind in a box and can't be done. Okay, it's like space. And phenomena are like clouds. So if we speak about the mental factors, they're like clouds. They come in the mind and they go out of the mind. Anger comes and anger goes. Love comes and love goes. Okay? They're like clouds. So these illusions, or not illusions, allusions, examples, you know, analogies, these are very, very helpful to think of. Yeah? And I think they're also helpful in our daily life. You know, just to recall this. You know, if your body doesn't feel so well, then just thinking, my body's like an illusion. Yeah, it helps the mind deal with what the body is feeling. Okay, if you're in a, you know, you're having a lot of mental suffering or a lot of physical suffering, and you think feelings are like a dream. You know, what I'm feeling, this happiness, this unhappiness, this pleasure, this pain, you know. You just got the best thing in the whole world that you thought, that you've always wanted, that you thought will really make you happy. And that happiness is like a dream. Yeah, comes and goes. Yeah. And then our mind, you know, that we're always looking for. And, yeah, mind is like space. Isn't it? So we go, oh, my mind is so uncooperative, I can't control my mind. Just sometimes say, oh, it's like space. And what is it that we can, you know, is making our mind so obnoxious sometimes? It's the mental factors. Yeah? The mental factors are like clouds. Yeah? And you notice that. You can see one meditation session, you know, you have a great session. Next session, mind is totally uncooperative. Have you noticed that? Yeah? You can't predict at all. Yeah? So really, like clouds. I mean, changing like the weather. Look at this. Okay? Okay, any questions? Yeah?
I was wondering about the links that the text has between the four establishments and then the four noble truths and then the four distortions. And is it like genuinely the case that each of them has more more apparently linked? Like, is the body really mm-hmm. more apparently linked with dukkha because they also all have those characteristics? Mm-hmm. As
right. Okay. So in linking the four. Objects of observation of mindfulness with the Four Noble Truths. This is a general way. It's like, because when we meditated on the common characteristics, we saw that all four objects have all four characteristics. Okay? But in terms of each object, it kind of specializes in a particular one. Okay, but each object has all four. Okay? Yeah. And so in that way, each object can be related to all four noble truths. It may be more particular to one. Because you can see, meditating on the foulness of the body, that, you know, that's going to be quite direct for helping you want to be free of true dukkha, isn't it? That's going to be quite direct. Yeah. The other ones, yes, will help you generate renunciation. But somehow meditating on the body is going to get you there. Real, you know, it's going to make it very strong for you. Okay? But you have to understand all four of them all four objects in terms of all four characteristics in terms of all four noble truths.
Mm-hmm. The one about it engages us in meditation on the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. Seems like that would also be true for the other hearers and solitary realizers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. But remember, the bodhisattvas are meditating on the Four Noble Truths regarding all mm-hmm. sentient beings. And also, because of having a Mahayana viewpoint or a Prasangika view of emptiness, the way they meditate on the Four Noble Truths is going to be different. Because they're going to see all Four Noble Truths as empty of true existence. Okay? Okay. So we'll dedicate. I know for some of you, you know, you may not have heard the beginning parts of these teachings, or there may be some vocabulary or ideas that's unfamiliar. That's okay. You listen, you understand whatever you can understand. You think about it. And then the next time you hear these teachings, you'll already have some foundation and you'll be able to understand it better. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiriya Tayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Oryutara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West. Glory.